June 18th, and we are here for a work session on House Bill 1516, which is the state school fund portion of the Department of Education. I'll open a work session on House Bill 1516. And committee members, just to kind of set the stage for what we are charged to do here, this will be, I think, a pretty heavy-duty information sharing session where my hope is to bring the members of the committee to a place where they have an understanding of the operation of the quality education model, and that we can use the model in leading ourselves into a discussion on funding levels for the state school fund. And so what I would ask of you today is that you pay particular attention to the assumptions for funding that are in the model, because what I'm going to be asking of the committee is that we essentially work our way through those assumptions and decide what we think are good assumptions to make in those spending areas, and come up with some relevant recommendations as to the level of the state school fund based on our discussion about the assumptions. And this will hopefully make a lot more sense to you as we proceed through this. I would like to just reiterate the way that the committee has operated in the past, and I hope will continue to operate, is members, please feel free to ask questions as we go along and seek clarification for things. And this is, I think, an extraordinarily important piece of what the committee has been charged to do in this session. And I would hope that the quality education model will be a framework that will be able to proceed to a reasoned and logical discussion on the funding level for the state school fund. So with that, I would turn it over to Sue McGlashan from the Legislative Fiscal Office to step us through some of the materials that we have in front of us. Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. You do have a number of materials in front of you, and I'll take a few minutes to orient you. The first one you should see after the agenda is a document that's entitled 2003-05 School Funding Levels. And what this one-page document is intended to do is just kind of refresh your memories on the different funding levels that you've probably heard about for the 03-05 budget, starting with the governor's budget of $5.051 billion. And the document kind of walks you through the more critical pieces of that number and what the assumptions are in that budget, such as no salaries, no COLAs and step increases, no health benefits increases, no SNS. It does allow for student growth, and it does assume a PERS factor of 16.71%, which was the rate that was assumed to be in effect for 03-05 when the governor's original budget was put together. And then the next section of that document shows you the co-chair's budget at $4.788 billion, which started with the governor's budget of $5.051 billion, but assumed a PERS rate of 12.69% and did not include the governor's $100 million add back to the state school fund budget.
Representative Bates.
Thank you. The 12.69 from the co-chairs, I forgot if that includes the PERS reform.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, it did assume some type of PERS reform. It was pretty early on in the session, so there wasn't real concrete knowledge of what the rate might be, but it did assume some PERS reform and some drop in the rate.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Follow up.
We know we put PERS reform in place. We know it's going to go to court. We have conflicting opinions on what that courts will do or not do to it. Does the LFO have any idea where the best spot to go to try to get a, and this is an important figure, this is a very important figure in setting this budget.
Representative Bates, if I might interject, we have a whole part of our agenda related to the discussion around the PERS number.
Thank you. I will hold my fire.
Okay.
And then to continue, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, then the governor came out with his first revised budget, which was basically the co-chair's budget, but he wanted to retain the $100 million add back. So his first revised budget was the $4.888 billion. And then he came out with a second revised budget of $5.3 billion. And I think when we get further into the discussion, perhaps the governor's education policy advisor can come up and speak to that amount. One approach has been described, though, as starting with a higher CSL and then assuming a 14% PERS rate and some salary growth rather than zero, and then some growth in health benefits instead of zero. So I think the thing to keep in mind as you work through all these different funding levels is that what you arrive at really depends on what assumptions you make in terms of things like the PERS rate, the health benefits rate, salary growth, and so on. And so that last section of this document is intended to kind of guide the discussion on how you do determine that level. The first part would be, of course, deciding what your base level is that you start with. And I might remind the subcommittee members that there were obviously certain cuts taken in the 2002 special sessions, and most of those cuts were considered permanent, and therefore they affected the roll-up of the budget to 0305. You could start with a higher base if you wanted to assume fewer permanent cuts, and we can talk more about that as we get into the discussion, particularly on the quality education model. And then there would need to be a decision on the PERS rate, and my understanding is the board is going to set that rate June 30th. And also I understand that regardless of what happens in the courts, once the rate is set for June 30th, that will be the rate that's in effect for the 0305 biennium. At least that's my understanding today. You would need to decide on what health benefits rate to put in the budget, whether you want to assume no growth in health benefits or if you want to select a different rate. And we've got some people here today, I think, who are prepared to talk about what's really going on out in the real world as far as growth in that area. Probably the key, one of the key decisions other than the PERS to make is whether or not you're going to keep with the principle of no salary increases for state employees and K-12 employees, including COLAs and step increases. And again, we have some people here today who are prepared to talk about what's happening out in the school districts with their collective bargaining agreements and how that might affect some of the assumptions that you would make for this budget. Another one would be to decide whether or not to keep with the principle of no inflation on S&S. And we'll talk more about that later as well. And then the student growth component of the budget is another factor to consider. And then finally, once you make these different assumptions and develop a budget, that budget level can be fed into the quality education model to see what kind of program level that you can buy for your schools. So that's that first document.
Senator Measurely, what I'd like to do is the last part of this list, so what's the level, how to determine, is what I kind of see as the game plan for stepping through the discussion to get the information to plug into the model. So if there are any questions or comments on that process, I would really appreciate having that discussion too. Senator Measurely.
Madam Chair, I just want to understand the governor's second revised budget. If I take, and tell me where I'm figuring this wrong, if I take $5.75 billion, subtract off $112 million, subtract off $114 million, and then this might be where I made a mistake, I subtracted off $286 million, and then $37 million, I come up with less than 5.3.
You've got to add the 286 here, I think.
Well, it says a net.
Well, when that's saving, that's true.
We will have Mr. Sager coming forward, and so perhaps those would be appropriate questions for him when he is at the dais.
Okay, thank you. Savings, doesn't it?
Right. Madam Chair, if I could clarify.
Yeah.
And I apologize if that section isn't clear. It would be taking the $5.75 billion and then subtracting savings of $286 and the salaries, $37 million in health benefits, and then $114 in PERS should get you to the 5.3. But again, Mr. Sager is here, and he could probably clarify that for you.
Okay. I guess you might.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a process question. Are we prepared, if need be, to spend more than this morning on the subject? There's a lot of material to digest.
And we've cleared the calendar for tomorrow also, and I'm prepared to rearrange the schedule even further. I see this as very, very critical.
I'm pleased to hear that. Thank you.
Ms. LaBlanche.
Thank you. Then, Madam Chair, after that, you should see a run of the quality education model, and as we get further into the discussion, we can discuss this in more detail, but this is for the members to see how, when you put certain things into the model, how it affects not only the level of funding, but also the program level that you can buy. Then there are some handouts from some of the speakers today, and the first one, I hope you have, is it shows at the top recent settlement show trends. And Ron Wilson from OSBA, I believe, is prepared to talk to you about this document, about some of the recent trends in bargaining. And then you should have, after that, handout from the Oregon Education Association, which also addresses salary issues. And that will be discussed further as well. And finally, there are two handouts from COSA. Apparently, a survey was done of school districts in regards to what they thought they would need in terms of funding levels to maintain full school year and other program aspects. So, Madam Chair, that wraps up my orientation of the documents that are before you. We have some people here today who are ready to talk about some of the more specific decisions that need to be made. Ron Wilson from the Oregon School Boards Association, Jim Sager from the Governor's Office, and Brian Reeder is here to talk about the quality education model and answer questions you may have on that. So
what I'll do then is call Mr. Wilson, Mr. Sager, and Mr. Reeder to come forward. And we also have Linda Ames from BAM here, who is an excellent resource on these issues and is available to answer questions and give information, and a number of other people that I'm seeing in the audience that have good information and knowledge about the situation in the schools and in the funding model. I don't know how you have decided to do this. On my agenda, Mr. Wilson is the first person. So if you are prepared, Mr. Wilson, and you could begin, that would be fine with me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ron Wilson. I'm the Director of Human Resource Development at the Oregon School Board Association. Thank you for allowing me to address you. One of the things that we do is to monitor what is happening with school district settlements in teacher contracts and, to a lesser extent, with classified contracts. When we look at the number of districts that were going to be engaging in bargaining because their contracts had expired, we put together a list of about 80 districts, and that's part of the attachment. The second page on the recent settlement trend handout. Now, of those 80 districts, That would leave about another 120 or so districts that have collective bargaining agreements that the districts are in the middle of. In other words, the term of their contract extends beyond the 2003-2004 school year. And in fact, if I look at the next year, the second year of the biennium, another 70 districts will have contracts expire. And that,
if I might just clarify for my own personal clarification, out of the 120 districts that are in a contract right now, 70 of them will, the contract will expire when?
June 30th, 2003.
Okay, of the 120, 70.
Well, the first 80 were
on the sheet.
On the sheet. These are, they've just signed their contracts.
These are contracts that expire June 30th, 2003.
And that's a subset of the 120 districts that are...
Madam Chair, that's a subset of the over 200 school districts. There's 198 K-12 school districts.
Okay.
And 21 ESDs. There are about 20 K-12 school districts that are so small that they really don't have a collective bargaining agreement. So that leaves about 200 districts total. So of that 200 total, 80 have contracts that are expiring June 30th of this year. So the negotiations for their successor agreements are already ongoing.
Okay. Then, so that leaves 120 districts that are in a contract process.
Correct. That they currently have a collective bargaining agreement.
Are there any districts that are working without a contract?
I believe one district is still negotiating a contract that expired in June 30th, 2002.
Okay.
So all of the other districts currently have a active collective bargaining agreement.
So it's actually 80 districts and not 70 districts that have contracts that expire on June 30th of this year?
Yeah, the list that I provided you was 80 districts that have contracts that expire on June 30th, 2003.
Okay.
The 70 district number is my estimate of those districts that will have contracts that expire June 30th, 2004.
Ah.
My apologies for not making that clear.
Yeah. Okay.
The remaining 50 districts, you got 80, 70, so about 50 left. Okay.
So 50 districts have contracts that expire after 2004.
Correct.
And are these generally, what's the duration of these contracts?
The average duration has been 3 years. One of the trends that I wanted to talk with you about was that as we're seeing some of the new settlements come in, we're tending to see shorter contracts.
And what is the contract duration that we're tending to see then?
We're tending to see more 1 and 2 year agreements as opposed to the 3 year agreements.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so the average duration is falling. In 1999, we had an average contract duration of 3.1 years. And my most recent data indicates that now that's dropped to about 2.9 years. So the contracts vary in length, and that contract duration is usually a function of the amount of uncertainty in the funding levels. Again, going prior to 2002, when we had such a decrease in the revenue in the state, there was more of a tendency to have 3, perhaps even 4 year agreements. But as that situation created an unstable environment, school districts and their exclusive representatives, the unions, are less able to predict what's going to happen in the future. One of the ways to balance that is to have a shorter contract. One of the other methods of kind of balancing some of that uncertainty is really the second trend that I've been seeing, is that is to provide some type of a hedge against the uncertainty of not knowing what the funding level is. So we're starting to see in contracts a provision called funding clauses or reopener provisions that say that if revenue drops either very sharply or gradually, if there's some significant reduction in revenues, then the parties go back to the bargaining table and reopen the agreement, talking usually about salary and insurance, which are the major portions of the collective bargaining agreement
so
expenses.
So, again, if I might interject just for my own personal clarification, the introduction of these reopening clauses is a relatively new phenomena?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
And which category, I mean, do we know how many districts now have that clause in their contracts, or is there, can you define it by the time that the negotiations took place? How can we get to that number?
At my office, we have a file of all of the contracts in the state. And I had one of my staff start to look through each of those contracts, picking out where we could find funding clauses. And we found that about less than 1% of the school districts actually had a funding clause that could be triggered to reopen the agreement. But one of the trends that I'm seeing is that as we're seeing these new agreements being made from last year all the way to the present time, I'm seeing an increase in those funding clauses. In other words, they're starting to appear more frequently in the agreements. So at the present time, there are not very many funding clauses in school district contracts for teachers anyway.
Okay. It would be helpful.
Representative Bates?
Rebell.
Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would be helpful for further clarification if you could tell us which districts are affected in that way, if not today, getting the information to us.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'd be more than happy to provide that information. But just as an example for you in the materials describing some of the more recent settlements since January, the Northwest Regional ESD on the back of the first page, there's a note there that a funding clause was established that was new to that particular district, and so it has a particular structure. If there is a revenue shortfall, then the parties will go back to the table. So that would be an example of one of the most recent funding clauses. And I'll be more than happy to provide some additional examples to the committee.
I think it would be instructive to the committee if we could get some kind of a display that shows the districts and when the contracts expire. I'm very curious too to know which of the districts have contracts that expire in 04 at the end of June, and the districts that don't fit into either the ones that expire on June 30th of 03 or 04, when those district contracts expire. And I would also be interested in knowing which of the districts have already built into the contracts the ability to reopen them and renegotiate the salary issues.
I actually have most of that information already. I've actually given it to Linda Ames from DAS, or I can also provide it separately to the committee, a list of all the districts in the state and what the terms, the duration, so to speak, of their contracts are. So that information is very readily available.
Okay. If you could, I don't want both of you to end up doing the same work concurrently, so I think it would just be good for the committee to have a display that gave us that information to work with. So if you could work together in the simplest possible way, get that to us, we would appreciate it. Senator Gordley, did you have a follow-up?
No, you're nailing down the detail. It's more than examples. We need all the information that affects all the districts.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be also very interested in two other pieces. One would be what's been happening with contracts since we've been in session. Now the districts are aware of the intense budget shortfall. I want to see what the reaction has been, so the contract signed in the last few months would be very, very helpful to know. I know in my area at least two of the contracts that are on this list here have been signed already. One does have an opt-out, and the other one I'm not sure if they do or not. I also like to do, if you could, when you give us numbers by district, it's very helpful, but district sizes vary hugely.
Mm-hmm.
And from my point of view, I do it the way we do it in health insurance. That's covered lives. And this one would be number of pupils under which kind of contracts. So we get a better idea of what the real cost is for those students. Just going district by district can be very misleading because you have a multiplicity of very small districts and a group in the middle of 5,000 or 6,000 kids. And you got the big districts, Salem, Kaiser, and Portland. So if you can give it to us by number of students under this type of contract would be helpful for me, at least.
So, Representative Bates, would I be correctly interpreting your data request if I said that if they could add a column to the display and put the number of pupils per in each district, that would work for you?
And just because I sometimes am mathematically challenged to do a little addition for me too. These many students are in contracts that have an opt-out. These many students are in one-year contracts. These many students are in two-year contracts.
So we want three separate columns.
Well, you do it all. You probably would. But just, you know, get a real picture of what those students look like, you know, because that tells you what's driving the cost. If you got 90 districts with an opt-out, but it's 10% of the population of students, it's not very meaningful.
Yeah.
So we need to know how many students are opt-outs, how many students are in one-year contracts.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we can provide that easily in an electronic format so you can sort on different columns, district size, length of or duration of the contract, or by the name of the district or even in the county that the district is in. So that's an easily sortable type of display. What I don't have comprehensive data on is every single new contract that has been concluded since January. While I've asked districts to send me these copies, sometimes they get very busy at the end of the school year, and so I don't have a comprehensive database of every single of the new contracts. So that part of the data is going to be quite spotty. But I'll provide what information that I have at this point.
Mr. Reeder, does the department have that information, current contracts, or copies of the contracts that are in force in the districts?
Brian Reeder, Department of Education. Chair Morgan, no. As far as I know, the department does not collect that information. We rely on OSBA for contract information.
This is kind of an aside, but I'm really curious as to why the database initiative project doesn't include that kind of specific information.
Chair Morgan, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. I think we're waiting for another piece of information here, so please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To continue a little bit on the reopener trend, there's a variety of different types of reopeners of which we've...
And finally, just interject, Representative Bates, you have a comment that you wish to make here.
In school's out, and so things require in the districts, there's still a lot of work to do. but this is pretty important information to know what those contracts are looking like out there in the last few months. And I would hope that the districts would be very cooperative in giving you those vital pieces of information. Reopeners, length of contract, you know, changes in salary, changes in steps, changes in health care. Those are really important issues for us in setting a budget at this end and knowing what the effect of that budget would be. And it's, with 200 districts all over the map, it's important for us to have some perception of what that looks like. I would hope the districts would be very cooperative.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I agree with you, and I also hope that the districts will be very cooperative. Part of our process is to send out reminders and surveys to try to get an update of the negotiation status of contracts in each of the districts. I do that in March, and then again, I do it again at the end of June. In order to get those contracts. The most responsive number of districts to that survey comes when I give the reminder at the end of the school year. So I'm anticipating that while now I only have about 27 contracts in my electronic database for 03-04, I'm hoping to get hopefully about another 100 or so in over the next 30 days. And that appears to be kind of the typical pattern that that I see from year to year. So I think the districts indeed are being responsive, but they have a little bit more time as the school year winds down than earlier in the year. The other factor is that during the period of time from January to June, is that's when most of these agreements are in fact being negotiated. So we don't see those settlements until the latter part of the school year. This year is a little bit different because of the high degree of uncertainty in the appropriation. A lot of districts got started late. They didn't really get started in the negotiations process until late February and March. In fact, there are some districts that didn't get started until April or May. So I'm also suspecting, and in fact one of the trends I wanted to talk with you about, was that the delays in bargaining are also reflective of the uncertainty of the appropriation. And I realize that this is a chicken and egg issue. Well, why should I agree from a district's perspective to a level of funding in my collective bargaining agreement if I don't know how much my appropriation is going to be? And from the legislature's perspective, it's, well, I don't know how much I want to give in the appropriation if I don't know exactly what those commitments are. So it is a little bit of a chicken and egg, but I believe most districts at this point that are still in bargaining are looking at what's happening in the legislature and seeing the wide range of discussions about the K-12 budget, and that uncertainty is also delaying settlements.
Well, I would submit to you, Mr. Wilson, that I don't think that we have ever funded the state school fund based on the settlement agreements that are negotiated between the districts and the unions, and that this time our what's hanging us up is that we basically don't know how much we have to spend. We're still in a declining revenue situation, and the uncertainty surrounding that and the pressure surrounding the needs to provide funding in all of the areas that the state provides services are, I think, what actually is driving our the length of time that it's taking us to come up with these numbers. But I would submit to you also that it is very important for the districts to realize the situation that we find ourselves in this building, and to also realize that it's only through the sharing of information and having all the cards be laid face up on the table and having a discussion around that reality that we're going to come to any kind of an end game here and any kind of a solution. So I would hope that the districts that do have that information and haven't relayed it to you at this point point, we'll see the seriousness of the issue from this side, and we'll expedite that information in your direction.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I think your observations are very accurate, and I think that school districts will, in fact, will be cooperative. And the problems that you've identified, I think, are also being mirrored at the collective bargaining table. When districts don't know their level of funding, they're much more reluctant to commit to a level of funding, whether it's the number of positions, let alone what pay is going to be established for those positions. So I think that's quite correct. What we have seen, and I need to come back a little bit to one of the observations that Representative Bates made, is our district really being responsive to what's happening at the legislature. And if I look at the settlement trends, I can divide the settlements from those settlements that were arrived at in a multiple year agreement 2 or even 3 years ago. For instance, if 03-04 is the third year of a three-year agreement, that means that the negotiations started in 2001. And so we have a number of those types of agreements. The average settlement was around 2% for those types of districts. If I then compare those districts that have started their renegotiation in 2002 and then through 2003, I'm seeing a steady decrease in those cost of living adjustments, or if there is a adjustments, it's like an example would be a 0.5%, but only coming in at the latter half of the year, so the actual cost is say 0.25%, or taking a 1% raise, splitting it, and doing the same thing with step increments, a movement down on the different steps in a salary schedule, delaying those steps, or in some cases not giving the steps. So that's one of the trends that I'm seeing in terms of salary and insurance, is that as that level of uncertainty is increasing, the settlements are starting to be more in tune with that uncertainty. But it's also the ability of the districts to renegotiate those contracts as they come due. In other words, as they expire, and then you engage in a renegotiations process. The description of some of the settlements are just those settlements that have been done since January. To give an example of some of the settlements and how they are measuring and trying to put together different levels of funding within the within what they believe is going to be their available funds.
I'm looking at the first district on the list, the Gladstone District, and it says three-year contract, 1%, 1%, 2% for each year respectively, with split schedules each year to reduce cost. Can you explain to the committee what that means?
Madam Chair, yes, the Gladstone contract was a three-year agreement. So the first year of that agreement, there was a 1% cost of living adjustment. But that 1% was split up into two different portions. A 0.5% was given at the beginning of the school year, September, and then another 0.5% in, say, January or February. So that would reduce the total cost during that year. And they use that method in all 3 years.
I have a question about that. If the district gives a 0.5% at the beginning in September and then another 0.5% in January, does the 0.5% that's given in September roll up into the basis for the half a percent that's given in January?
Madam Chair, typically the answer would be yes.
So it ends up being more than a 1% increase then?
No, it actually, Madam Chair, it actually would be slightly less than a 1%, about 0.8, 0.9%. Because if it was 1% for the entire year, that we know that would be 1%. But that half a percent is, for the first half of that year, is less. So it's going to be about 0.8, 0.9% total cost for that year. So it'll be slightly less than 1%.
I'm not tracking with you on this one. If I start out with a salary of a dollar, mm-hmm. and I get a one cent increase in January, then in June my increase is rolled up on $1.01. Correct?
I'm not sure I'm following, Madam Chair. If the increase is 1 cent for the entire year, these types of schedules give, essentially just divide that by giving a half cent in the first half of the year and a half cent in the second half of the year.
But is the percentage of increase that's given in the second half of the year computed on the base pay at the beginning of the year, or is it computed on the pay in the middle of the year?
I think I understand the question now, Madam Chair. The typically the percent increase, if it's a half percent and a half percent, isn't a cumulative percent increase. It takes 1% of the salary at the beginning of the year, and that's all that number is calculated on. So it's not a cumulative one half a percent on top of another half percent.
Okay. Mr. Sager, you look like you really want to say something.
No, I'm sorry. For the record, James Sager with the Governor's Office, I was understanding your confusion, as Mr. Wilson indicated. So in your example, you would have gotten, the district calculates the cost of the 1% for the year and only allocates the first half of that in the first half of the year, the second half in the second half of the year. So at the end of the year, the effect is a 1% increase, but it wasn't a half a percent plus then half a percent compounded against the half that it already
Thank you. Thank you. Now, if I could put you back on track of it, finishing explaining what that sentence means.
So in each of the 3 years of the Gresham contract, that's what they did. They divided whatever the scheduled increase was into two parts. So that the total cost during the term of that agreement was would be slightly less. So the
if I might just get into this one more layer here.
Yes.
So at the end of the first year of the contract, there's been a net 1% increase in the pay scales. When you go into the second year of the contract, is the next 1% increase predicated on the roll-up on the first year, or is again predicated on the beginning salary?
Madam Chair, typically it is that second 1% is on top of the 1% that was given in the first year.
So you compute the second 1% on where you're at the end of the first year?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair. So the splitting of the schedules doesn't have a cumulative effect, but the year-to-year percent increase does.
Okay.
So for each of the 3 years of the contract, they did that type of a split, and they set their insurance contributions at the 97% level. Which established a cap on their contribution, and they were moving from a program that was fully paid, whatever the premium was, to the 97% of that, and then the 3% would be picked up as an out-of-pocket premium contribution by the employees.
So there will be then a roll-up cost in their health care insurance program, too. There will be an increased cost there.
Yes, there will be an increased cost, and the overall cost of health insurance premiums looks to be going up about 17-18%.
Yeah. Per year? Per biennium? Per
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, that's the increase that is for the 03-04 school year. The insurance premium increases, of whatever they are on a year-to-year basis. We don't know what they're going to be beyond the insurance year that we're coming to.
This contract in the Gladstone District, does January signify when it was signed or when it goes into effect, or what does that mean?
Madam Chair, January is the month in which that settlement was reached.
Okay, and so this is just when the deal was struck. This doesn't relate to when the contract is signed or when it starts. Okay.
No, Madam Chair, typically what we do is that we don't actually include the data for a school district's contract in our electronic database and report that until there is a fully ratified agreement, and then we work from the from that agreement itself to put the information into the database.
Is it possible to give us some typical time that passes between the settlement being reached and the contract being ratified?
Madam Chair, generally the contracts end up being ratified within 30 days of the parties reaching a tentative agreement. It's only a very unusual circumstance that the ratification meetings really would be delayed beyond that 30-day point.
And what functionally is ratification?
Madam Chair, ratification is the process by which from the union side, the rank and file vote on whether or not to accept the contract, and from the school board perspective, during a public meeting, they vote to accept the contract from the board's perspective. So it requires a voting process from both sides in order to ratify the contract. Once those ratifications occur, then that contract becomes a legally binding document.
With reference to the Gladstone contract, what is this replacing? What I'm curious about is the contract that this supersedes, was it had the terms of it already run out, or when was it due to have stopped?
If, Madam Chair, if I can just check my list. That I was referring to earlier, I believe that the Gladstone contract expired in 2002. I don't have it by alphabetical order, so I'm having to just look through to see if I can find it. The Gladstone contract, just prior to this, I had already updated my database to the 2002-2005, so I'd have to go back in my historical database. But I believe it was a three-year agreement also that expired in 2002.
So it would have expired in June of 2002?
It would have expired June 30th, 2002, and the new agreement was actually arrived at in January of 2003.
Another question I have is kind of a process question. I'm curious about why June 30th is the date at which the contracts are, the lines drawn in the sand time-wise. Why isn't it April or September or December?
Madam Chair, the expiration of the contracts coincide with the end of the fiscal year. During any one fiscal year period, from July 1st to June 30th is when the expenditures for the school district are done. So it's just a fiscal year basis. Now, not all collective bargaining agreements are on the fiscal year. It's just the majority of them, like 99.9%, are. But there are a few agreements that have a different term. The one I'm thinking of runs from September through September to September, but still is a calendar year or a 12-month period of time. It just starts in September. That's a classified agreement. But most of them do run for at least a single year and coincide with the fiscal year.
And one of the issues I think that continually comes up, and it's been an issue since I've been in the building, is that for us to have reached an agreement in this building on funding levels, even in the best of times, with time frames that meet the needs of the districts in their salary negotiations, is real problematic. And so I've always been curious about why there isn't a realignment of the contract time so that the districts do go into negotiations with a much more solid knowledge of what they've got to work with. And we have had a lot of discussions in this building about how we kind of have the cart before the horse on the issue of negotiating teacher salaries, because the districts clearly are in a position of being in negotiating on salaries before they have any idea how much money they had.
Madam Chair, yes, that does become an issue for discussion at the bargaining table. When the state first got into the biennial funding, a number of us had speculated that the duration of contracts will coincide more and more with the biennial funding years. What we found is that different districts are in different financial straits. Those districts, for instance, that are in a high growth area, that they're having an increase in the number of students, they're getting additional funds through the funding formula because it's an ADM-based formula. And they were a little bit more comfortable sometimes extending beyond the biennium, sometimes into the first year of the next biennium. The second factor that I've been able to identify is that if we look at the last few legislative sessions, it seems like that the actual appropriation is coming more towards the end of that session rather than, I think it was four sessions ago, it actually came right at the beginning. So that trend now is, I think, also reinforcing the shorter duration contracts, just because of the phenomenon that you're observing, which is we don't know what that level of funding is. And as that uncertainty increases, that's shortening the duration of the contracts. So I think that by just the natural process of renegotiating these contracts in this environment, we're going to see more contracts come into line with the biennial funding. Now, that's also the function of funding clauses and reopeners, to say that if our assumptions that we're making don't hold true, then the parties will go back to the bargaining table and work out a new deal. The advantage for a longer-term agreement is you're putting less time and resources into negotiations. You have a greater chance for labor peace during that particular time. Now, despite that, the other mechanism that I'm seeing is that even if you have a multiple-year contract, it may not be just for economics. In fact, it may be for the language, non-economic portions of the agreement, and then take the first year, in this case, for those negotiating now, would be the 2003-2004 year, and then have a planned reopener for the second and the third year for salary and insurance, as the parties are more aware and they get more information about what that level of funding will be. Just last night came to a tentative agreement with a group that is a four-year agreement for language. We've established what we think is pretty much a cost-neutral settlement for the 2003-2004 year, and the parties plan to renegotiate in years 2, 3, and 4 for a limited reopener on salary and insurance. So there's various mechanisms that the parties can use to balance that unknowns, and it's not just contract duration.
So the negotiating process then is evolving along with what is evolving in this building.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely correct. And in fact, the collective and bargaining environment now is quite different than it was even 3 years ago. And primarily that's due to our experience, not just what's happening at the legislature, but what's been happening in the state, particularly in 2002, that every quarter we seem to have gotten worse news, which has made the funding crisis even worse. So districts and unions, I think, are very aware of that fact, and they're trying to craft agreements that will provide to meet the interests of both sides.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Just an observation. It strikes me that the discussion we're having is a good argument for annual sessions. Instead of requiring districts to adapt to what many of us view as a dysfunctional process of creating budgets, we still have the opportunity to shift to annual sessions and restructure the way that we craft these budgets so that our districts aren't left in the situation that the good gentleman has been describing. So again, just an observation.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think that whether or not the legislature is in annual sessions or not, I think from the collective bargaining perspective, the parties will still try to construct multiple-year agreements to the ability that they can, because those multiple-year agreements establish a degree of stability. And if there's anything that the educational environment needs, it needs that measure of stability in order to function most effectively. So you may be quite correct about in terms of your observations, but from the collective bargaining perspective, we're still going to want to look at those multiple year agreements to the ability that we can.
Senator Meserly agrees with me.
I'm sure I'll put that on the record.
Okay. Mr. Wilson, have we come to the end of what you were wanting to discuss with us? Or do you have more issues that you want to talk to us about?
Madam Chair, I've come to the end of the plan discussion items. I'd be, of course, respond to any questions or even if...
Any questions? Representative March, you look like you need to make a comment here.
Well, I just was calculating some numbers based on your question about the possible compounding and the difference, say, on a $36,000 salary, that if you did a 0.5% the first 6 months and you compounded that 0.5% the second 6 months, it amounts to 48 cents difference in a year for one salary. So it's very minuscule.
But and I think where I was more trying to reach clarification on how the process worked than
I was looking at net effect.
Editorial comment on one side or the other.
No, I wasn't. I was just trying to figure out net effect.
Are there any more questions or comments for Mr. Wilson? If you could just stay there, and we'll go, Mr. Sager, if you could present your material to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, James Sager, Governor's Office.
Yes, you do.
I guess the way I'd like to approach my comments are to cover three different areas very quickly. One is to answer some of the questions that were brought up earlier about the governor's second revised budget and kind of how we came to that number. So let me begin there. We approached that number really from three different perspectives. With the help of Linda Ames, we used the more traditional continuing service level type calculation, and then we backed out assumptions against those calculations. We also used what is called the, or what I refer to anyway, as the baseline quality education model. That is going back to the 2000-2001 year where the baseline was established, rolling those costs forward, and then again putting in some assumptions, the assumptions being a 9% increase in the health care, which was the PEB declared rate, a 14% increase in PERS, because again we felt that that was a number that was safe beyond any sort of legal challenges that may take place within the process, so that whatever number was established, we knew we weren't putting the school districts at risk, that we were saying a lower number and then turning out that they had a liability that was higher. And so we were trying to take those things. So we had those two kind of mathematical calculations.
Did you, Matt, if I might just ask further clarification, what were the assumptions that you used for salary roll-ups and inflation?
Madam Chair, I went ahead and included the inflation factor in there because I don't believe that the districts will be able to convince PGE or others to not increase their rates. And then I also...
Did you use the full inflation factor that was in the model, or did you go in and pick it apart?
No, within those service areas, I used the full inflation model. The full inflation factor that's in the model. On the salary portion, what we did is we cut that in half, again, because of the trends that we see, and I don't want to deviate too much from my comments, but I have some follow-up information I think that we can add to Mr. Wilson's comments about kind of the trends that we see in the collective bargaining agreement. So we used those calculations in looking at the model, came up with a number. It was about 5.312. And so mathematically, we came to a very similar number using those formulas. The third piece then was to ask Ozzie Rose from COSA to get feedback from the districts to see if, in fact, when this money goes through the system, what does it mean to them? And are they able to meet the three requirements that the governor has laid out, which is provide a full school year, maintain reasonable class sizes so there wouldn't be a dramatic increase in class size, and not have further cuts in programs that we're currently providing to the children. The documents that I provided to you from Ozzie's work from COSA gives you a list of the districts that were able to give us feedback very quickly, showing you the various numbers. But if you turn to what would be the fourth page of the document that has all the districts listed, you'll see that must be the back page. I'm sorry. If you turn to the very back page, it shows that at North Clackamas, which is about 11 lines up from the bottom, we finally dropped below the 5.3. In other words, that was the trigger for us, that we said that the majority of districts would need that much to restore or to maintain the full year, maintain reasonable class size, and maintain the program level that they're providing. And so we were trying to get from both the mathematical calculation perspective and kind of the on-the-ground approach. The second document that they provide us were comments.
I'm not tracking on where you're coming from with this data. Can you run through this again?
Yes. We asked the districts to give us feedback based upon looking at the budgets that they have established for themselves, and most of these districts use 4.8, 4.9 as their calculation based upon what the co-chair's revised budgets were, or the co-chair's budgets were in the governor's revised budget. They used one of those numbers to calculate for purposes of next year's budget. And in that calculation, they identified a series of cuts that they were going to have to make that they felt, and oftentimes it was cutting programs, it was increasing class size, or in the case of one school district, in fact, they've decided to start school late because they're not sure if they're going to have to cut days, and it's easier to add days to the end of the year than it is to partway through the year cut days. And so, they took a variety of approaches. So our question was to them, based on different levels and if you look at the second page of the document that starts at the top, memorandum, we provided them approximately how much more money they would get per ADMW at each level. It's about $75.
Levels, okay.
Right. So then they were able to look at that and say, if we could, what would it take us using this calculation to, and then knowing how that affects the state, the macro number, what would it take for that district to restore the programs that they were going to be cutting? And this is what their feedback is for us. So then, so you have the effect of the macro number, 5.3 or 5.6, but then how does it affect the individual school district and their budget? And so we're trying to get those two relationships.
Again, let me try to clarify this so that I can make sure that I'm tracking. The scenario was to consider the 02-03 close of session budget before any of the special session stuff happened. Was that the starting point here?
Madam Chair, actually the starting point would have been after the first two special sessions, because that's what the districts adjusted their budgets to, or their actual programs to.
In my recollection, and please correct me if it's not correct, mm-hmm. was that after the first two special sessions, there were no cuts to K-12. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, after
I thought it was in the third and fourth special sessions where we... The third special session where we actually did the retime.
Madam Chair, the second special session, I believe, is when we had that $112 million cut
from the school improvement fund. From the school improvement fund, yeah.
The third special session was when the shift occurred, which was assumed to be not a cut because districts could approve those resources from their first payment in 03-04. And I believe those were the... there was one more. There was a $20 million reduction as a result of the former governor's veto of one bill, which would mm-hmm. have provided for bonding funding from cigarette tax revenues, I believe. And the Measure 28 cut, of course, didn't take effect until January of 03.
Okay.
And, Linda, am I forgetting anything off the top? Okay.
I don't think so.
So the discussion, the baseline for the question that was asked of the districts under this scenario was the regular session budget less the, what was it, 119 in the school improvement
112,
fund?
112, Madam Chair.
112. In the school improvement fund. Okay, so that's like $5.2 billion less the $112 million.
That's correct.
Okay.
And what I'm not sure about, Madam Chair, and maybe Jim can answer this, is the veto occurred in, after the June special session. The legislature came back in to consider the two vetoes, overrode one and not the other. And I think, would the schools have known at that time that they were going to have less funding, or would they have planned their 0203 assuming no vetoes of those bills?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure on the $20 million, again, because as it filters through the system up to the districts, I'm not sure that it was significant enough at that point for them to make any major program adjustments because of the impact.
And actually, one other thing, Madam Chair, the additional funding from the cigarette tax revenue bonds would have put the schools at a net $82 million at the end of special session three. So they may have been making these program or planning these budgets based on an $82 million cut. Is that correct?
Again, Madam Chair, I'd have to go back and double check all the calculations at each district. Again, what we were focused on was the program level that for this school year, the one we just completed, that they had at least entered the school year, assuming that they were able to, or they had begun the school year, assuming that they had were able to provide to the students. And based upon that and then what they thought would be the next biennium's budget level, 4.7, 4.8, 4.9, that what kinds of program cuts were they going to have to make in addition to that. So then we ask, okay, to restore up to that level, what would it take? So we kind of maintain that service level because we backed out the special money that was supposed to be targeted for K through 5 math and reading. That money was already off the table. Now we were just back down to kind of the core program level without the additional emphasis.
Then the other piece that I'm not clear on, again, is at the district level, mm-hmm. what were their funding assumptions for things like salary increases, health care rates, services and supply roll-ups, and all the other things that go into making the number?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I think that at least part of your answer or part of your question will be addressed in the comments here, and so that's why we included that, because in some cases the district said they could use 5 point whatever number assuming all the per savings was calculated or assuming, you know, these scenarios.
They're all over the board.
Where they're different, they tried to identify them here based on the way that they had constructed their budget or used this information.
Okay.
Senator Mazzarin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope this is the appropriate time to ask this question, but as we look at the calculations on the needs of the individual districts, it really seems to me that we have two problems going on here. And it's my understanding that about 65% of the districts in the state are losing enrollment or have lost enrollment. And that makes an additional double whammy, I guess you could call it, on those districts. Is there any way we could break that out of the true cost of education and what the districts are losing because of the economy and the communities, their loss of enrollment, which relates to the economy?
Madam Chair, Senator Miserly, that's a very good question. I don't have an answer. I'm not sure if Brian could help us with that or Linda behind me, but it is a major challenge. I know several of the districts in their comments made reference to the fact that they have additional uncertainty because they are losing students, and that ties back to the whole discussion about what is a quality education, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, and thus what is the service that the remaining students in that district can be provided, and does that cost more per student than it would if the enrollment was higher and they were able to disperse that cost?
I'm sure if I could follow up with a comment. And that's all over the board. Some districts have been losing enrollment for the last 3 to 5 years or whatever. Some have been losing enrollment for the last 20 years. And a good example is North Bend, which is in my district, who are over 100 again this year. And that's been going on probably at least 15 years for them. So when you keep adding to that, they simply can never catch up. Matter of fact, they just go farther in the hole every year. And I'd like to, if we could, develop some information. And you know, I've got a bill laying there that would partially address this, but I think it's something that, as we look at education in total, we need to address that. I recognize that the growing districts also have a problem, but at least they do catch up. At least they have increased enrollment to cover part of their bases. That does put them in a bind for the short term, but long term, they work their way out of it. Those that are losing enrollment are in just an impossible situation, in my opinion.
Madam Chair, Senator Miserly, thank you. I made a note, and we need to work on that some more. Thank you.
And again, I haven't seen this before, so bear with me as I kind of bumble through this here. But in reading the anecdotal information, I've come to the bottom of the first page, and the only one that actually gives any basis in their assumptions is Klatskanai at the bottom of the page. And they have their PERS at 18.6 and 70% insurance increases. Caution people that none of the districts above that on this list gave any kind of assumptions at all, just gave a bottom line number that they needed. And one district has assumptions that are very much on the high end of the scale.
Madam Chair, again, and that's why we wanted to share this information with you so that we weren't trying to hide or you know, imply that we had somehow controlled all the assumptions that the districts used. As I indicated, COSA and from my office have indicated to districts that we thought to be safe, using 13-14% for a PERS number was a safe number. Districts may or may not have chosen to do that. But these districts are reflecting what they have, either contractual obligation with employees or contractual obligation because of agreements they have with insurance providers or utilities and others, that these are the realities that they are facing. And so we just, again, wanted to share the information with you.
Okay.
If I may, I would just, I think Representative Bates had asked that the new chart be developed where we look at district size and see how many students are affected, et cetera, regarding collective bargaining agreements. I think it's informative to look at just three of our largest districts, Portland, Salem, and Eugene, who have either through new contract negotiations or reopener. In the case of Portland, as Mr. Wilson indicated in his document, the teachers there agreed to not only work 10 days for free, but that amounted to a 5.3% pay cut for all the employees. Even though they worked, their pay was reduced by that. They have, in year two of their agreement, one of these kind of half movements, as Mr. Wilson indicated, so that they get a 0.5% increase at the beginning of this next school year in September, another 0.5% in January. So it's 0.75% cost to the district during that time. Eugene has negotiated an agreement where both years of their contract, the employees that earn a step, those that aren't already at the top of the salary schedule, receive only a 0.5 step. And they don't receive a COLA until the end of the first year. They get a 1% COLA at the end of the first year. So it's in the second year that the employees gain that benefit and the district has a cost. In Salem, they reopened and agreed to forego the COLA. So in the case of both school district boards, management, and employees, people are really trying to step up and work together to address the funding crisis that all of us are grappling with. And those three districts have a major impact on the number of children. And so I think, again, that's a trend that shows that everyone in the system is really trying to work hard to provide a good education and balance that with the cost constraints that we have or the revenue constraints we have.
Mr. Sager, I don't know if you have an answer to this, but it's something that's been puzzling me that the governor came out before the legislative session with his first budget proposal that he put on the table, and he made real clear in there the assumptions for funding in the K-12 school system, and part of that was no salary roll-ups and no increases in costs, and the assumptions were very detailed and the expectations were very detailed, and the projected revenue savings were right there against every one of those assumptions. I'm real curious how that ended up being translated into the real world, and we have, as a matter of course, seen salary increases in the contracts. I mean, how does that get reconciled?
Madam Chair, I wasn't here during the time that the original budget was pulled together. I didn't start on the governor's staff until March 1st, so I can't give you detailed, you know, experience information on that. I can only share with you the thoughts that have been shared with me from the governor's staff and the governor himself as to the thought process. As you know, when you come, you're elected as governor and you have to get up to speed very quickly and by the Oregon Constitution put out a balanced budget in a very short period of time and trying to look at all the various scenarios, that is what the governor did. Since that time, he has come to understand some of the effects that the earlier maybe decisions that didn't have complete information, but that was all that was available at the time, what those conclusions caused as it gets to the school districts or other parts of the budget. So in the course of going back and reevaluating, looking at what the impact in the case of the school budget, the impact of schools and children, and maintaining his priority of children, has adjusted his calculation to understand that in order to meet his three criteria, the full school year, no dramatic increase in class size, and no further reduction in program to children, that it takes this higher number. Also recognizing, as he does, because he is very intimately...
So what I hear you say is, in order to maintain class size and maintain a full school year, rolling the number up is necessary?
No, Madam Chair, what I'm suggesting is that to maintain those three elements that I suggested.
Which is class size.
Class size, program, and the full school year.
And the full school year.
Right. And understanding, as the part I missed here, as understanding the effect of collective bargaining, et cetera, but at the same time calling on districts to be very frugal in that effort, that we're required to now have a minimum of $5.3 billion in the school fund as those dollars make it down to the districts.
Well, then how do you reconcile being able to... fund a full school year and maintain class size and maintain programs according to the quality education model at a much lower funding level?
Madam Chair, there are two different parts of the quality education model, because what it does is it provided us a baseline calculation. That is, as of 2000-2001, what were the models baseline level of class size, program, and thus the funding that goes along with it. Then we also have, again, the model based on a 90% projection, getting 90% of our children to our academic standards, what it would cost at that level. When we calculated the 5.3 number, we were looking at this baseline. That is, we didn't take into consideration the fact that both as a state and as a nation, we need to move more of our students towards those high academic standards. So, again, looking at the baseline, saying we're just going to try to maintain where we are, what does that calculation come forward? And so that's why in the quality education model, using the baseline calculations, not full implementation or not a commitment to move us towards full implementation or having all children meet high standards, what would that funding level be? And so it is clearly a floor again, looking at the economic conditions that we faced, that we felt we could not drop below that floor.
And, Madam Chair?
Again, if I might just interject, Senator Gordley, The basis of the discussion is the assumptions that you make and put into the model, and it's the baseline of funding mm-hmm. that you start with. And it is how you, there are issues, I think, that we'll get into as we proceed through the list of assumptions here about the equity of treating one part of government differently from another part of government, which I think is a huge issue of trust and integrity that this process has to deal with, and also the assumptions that you're going to build into your model to get where you want to go, and that I would submit to you very respectfully that there are very slippery issues here that need to be picked apart and examined discreetly before the thing is combined back together. And I think that one of the hopes that I have for the discussion that we're going to have in this committee is that we can do that on the basis of the discrete components of the model.
Madam Chair, I absolutely agree. I appreciate the fact that we are at least trying to work using a similar model, and then if we can have the discussions to come to agreement as to what the components are, what the inflationary factors are used, et cetera, then, in fact, maybe we can come to agreement on an exact number. Thank you.
Senator Gordley, I'm sorry to have cut you off.
Oh, no problem. First a question and then a request. Clarification, Mr. Sager, the QEM baseline or the floor is what?
I'm sorry, I missed the
quality education model baseline number, the floor, as you put it, is what? The dollar figure.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, again, as we calculated it using our assumptions, it came out as 5.312.
Okay. Now stop there. Okay. Madam Chair, my request is this.
That was 5.312 was your base?
No, it's a QEM.
Madam Chair, again, using the baseline of the quality education model and rolling those numbers forward to this next biennium, with the assumptions we use for this next biennium, our number, I believe, and I don't have it right in front of me, I believe it was 5.312 is the number that is in my head, but 5.3 is what we could round it off to.
Okay, so I'm confused here because I thought that your base was the 0203 legislatively adopted budget up to the end of the second special session.
Madam Chair, again, we were using, as I tried to outline earlier, we were using two different mathematical calculations to see if we came to a similar conclusion. Linda Ames used what I call the more traditional model, looking at a funding year and using the continuing service level calculations, both adding, rolling those costs forwards and subtracting out certain assumptions. I was using the quality education model baseline and rolling those numbers forward, coming to approximately $5.3 billion. So that gave us two different, again, mathematical scenarios that got us to that point. And then the third step that we took was to get feedback from school districts. And so the quality education model, as it was run through the computer calculations, didn't assume a 5.75 number. That number was derived by backing out the Governor Kitzhaber's commitment to have the additional money go into targeting K-5 math and reading. That got us down to 5.75, and then we looked at the assumptions inside the calculation.
Where does the 5.75 number come from?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I really don't want to confuse you more. It's just that I have been involved with also so many conversations like you of different people using different numbers at me that I hope that I'm not misquoting. But it says, starts with a higher continuing service level of 5.75. That's on the document that Sue provided. And so that's the number that I was referring to.
Madam Chair, and if I could just yes, add to that, it would just assume that not all the cuts that were originally assumed to be permanent cuts from 0203 would roll forward as permanent cuts. So if you start with a higher
base. The basis for the roll-off was higher.
Higher, that's
okay.
Correct. And I think, Madam Chair, this conversation just underscores the importance of how all the different assumptions can affect mm-hmm. the
yes,
budget
I agree
that you
with
would wind
you.
Up with.
Absolutely.
Senator Gordley, please continue.
Thank you. Again, I'm glad that we're getting a clarification of what we mean when we say baseline or how much we're talking about when we say yes. baseline. And, Madam Chair, my other request is this. We're going to be talking about a model that was developed by a group of people, none of whom are in the room, I don't believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. I would like to have present, as this discussion continues, people who served on that commission, people who helped develop the model so that as we're talking about these assumptions, we know what we're talking about. And I don't think we can go further in a real definitive way
without having that expertise in the room. So that's my report.
Ms. McGlash. Madam Chair, if I could just say that we do have Brian Reeder from the Department of Education, who I consider to be quite an expert, both from the policy aspects of the model and certainly from the technical aspects of the model. So I think you should consider him a very good resource in addition to any other people you wanted to have come and talk about the model.
And I do want to clarify, this is not to diminish in any way the expertise that Mr. Reeder brings, but there are some nuances around these assumptions and discussions that took place within the commission and all the meetings that they participated in that resulted in their commission report to the legislature and the governor that we're not all totally and fully aware of. And in order for us to make truly enlightened decisions, I think we need to have that expertise in the room. So.
Senator Gordley, I would be very happy if you would identify individuals to ask them to come and speak with us, and perhaps we could do that when the session is finished.
Okay, that would be great.
And Madam Chair, if I could address Senator Gordley's request, part of the reason that the governor is so committed to looking at the quality education model is because both he and I did serve on the commission. But I don't consider myself expert enough to give you the full detail analysis as I think Senator Gordley would like to have. And there are people that can provide that expertise. But we understand not only the value of the model when it comes to the budgetary implications of it, but also the value of the model when it comes to defining what a quality education is. Two of the major processes that we went through when we devised the model was to look at best practices around the country and say, what are the things that we have can identify that directly impact the academic success of children, and how is that reflected in a school, whether it be an elementary, middle, or high school? The other component was constant communication with the general public, asking them, how do we as Oregonians define a quality education? So that as a commission, we didn't define it, say, as just reading, math, and social science. But we also included those elements in the plan that Oregonians identified through extensive surveys and focus groups that they felt were elements that were necessary. So that created the model. And then we looked at what are those intangibles, what are those issues that sometimes you just can't quite get your hand on, but in fact, again, research has indicated has a direct effect. It may not be a short-term effect, but it may be several years down the road that you're able to see that it had an effect on the outcome of children. So we try to incorporate all those things into the model. The other major component of the model is that it can give us a path to move our children from where they are today to, as the model had originally designed, getting 90% of our children to our high academic standards, but now No Child Left Behind requires us to adjust that up to 100%. That's an additional calculation that needs to be done. But even, and that, quite honestly, is down the road a ways, a few years, as far as the way the federal law is laid out. But it does give us a roadmap to begin making a commitment to our children as to how we begin to close the gap between those children that currently do not meet our standards and those that do, without diminishing the educational opportunity for those that already meet the standards. So we have both of those challenges, and those of us that did serve on the commission and the members that currently serve on the commission feel very strongly that this is a pathway that can give us some guidance.
I just looked at the clock and went, oh, no. We have not even had a chance yet to listen to Mr. Reeder talk to us about what the actual assumptions in the model are. Mr. Sager, is this your display or is this?
This was a document that I provided to Sue and to Linda to help us again, as we were looking at, and Brian, to look at what are some of the trends and what are some of the costs, et cetera. And so these are some pages that were provided for your information. These documents were provided from the OEA.
Madam Chair.
Senator Messer.
It's unfortunate, just as we're getting into the meat of things, that we're out of time. But as I look over this information, it's helpful, but it's not as meaningful, in my opinion, as it could and should be. And it would seem to me to be important that the same questionnaires as to what are the needs of the individual districts. And I don't know how the question was asked, but it would be very important that the question be asked with certain assumptions, definite assumptions, so that we can compare. The way it is now, where they are all assuming different things, from COLAs to insurance to PERS to who knows whatever else, it's really not a very meaningful number that at least I can get my arms around and say, here's some figures that we need to seriously take a hard look at. And it might be too difficult. On the other hand, with emails, I would think they could true this up quite rapidly.
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, I'd be happy to talk with Ozzie Rose and see if we might be able to, again, use his services in helping us to meet that need.
Appreciate it.
Committee members, I had considered seeing if we could continue this hearing this morning, but I have just been reminded that we have on the floor of the House the reconciliation bill that we passed out of the full committee yesterday, and I am the carrier of the bill. What I would like to do is adjourn the meeting for today, but I will ask that the members be excused from the respective floor sessions tomorrow so that we can have the discussion run over if we need to, because I would like to get the committee to a place by the end of tomorrow's committee meeting where we are ready to propose some assumption levels to be put into some funding models. So if the members of the committee could organize their lives accordingly, I would very much appreciate it. And thanking you for your time this morning, Mr. Reeder, I'm very sorry that we dragged you over here not to even get one word out of you, but hopefully we'll reverse our trends tomorrow.
Sure.
And with that, I'll adjourn the committee, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.